I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Lectures and Literature at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you the voices of remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is novelist Howard Jacobson, who is joined in conversation by Peter Stein, Executive Director of the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Howard Jacobson and Peter Stein.
Dating back to 1969, the Man Booker Prize for Fiction is the best-known, most hotly debated and eagerly sought literary award in the British Commonwealth. When Howard Jacobson won the prize in 2010 for his 11th novel, The Finkler Question, it was the first time in 24 years that it was awarded to a comic novel. Like Shakespeare, only more so, The Finkler Question links tragedy to comedy. Storylines of bereavement and thwarted hopes of belonging modulate Jacobson's gags. The chairman of the judging panel, Andrew Motion, called The Finkler Question, quote, a marvelous book, very funny, of course, but also very clever, as Mr. Jacobson's work generally is. But it is also, in a very interesting way, a very sad, melancholic book. It is comic, it is laughter, but it is laughter in the dark, end quote. As a novelist, Howard Jacobson insists that being funny should go without saying. To me, being a comic novelist is obviously to be serious, too. What else is there to be comic about? Indeed, there is an ominous undercurrent in the book in the form of a growing number of anti-Semitic attacks, mostly offstage, that shatter the complacency of characters who resist the notion of Jews as perpetual victims. Mr. Jacobson says that such incidents worry him too, and that some of the views and the cacophony of arguments and counterarguments in the book reflect his own opinions. Like one of his characters, Mr. Jacobson adheres to the notion rooted in Talmud that every argument has a counterargument. But enough from me. Here tonight to get the conversation off the ground with Howard Jacobson is Peter Stein, Executive Director of the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival. Please join me in welcoming them both to the JCCSF.
Howard, welcome back. Thank you. San Francisco.
Wonderful to be back.
I have to say the last time that we saw each other, I had the pleasure of welcoming you as a guest at our film festival because what's not maybe obvious from the writings that you've done is that you have also a long and storied career as a presenter and a on-camera personality, I guess it's called, in the UK. But here we're here to talk about your book, and particularly a group congratulations to you for this extraordinary accolade, the Man Booker Prize.
Thank you.
I don't see a laurel wreath. I don't see a halo. Tell us, though, how this might have changed things for you.
Well, it's the fact that I am here. More than that, the fact that you are here. I did do an event at in San Francisco about 4 years ago for a slightly earlier novel called Kaluki Nights. I was staying in a little hotel, which was like a steel prison just up the road here. And I thought I would be doing the event here in this beautiful building, but I didn't. I was in a public library not far away, and I went to the public library, and there were eight people. Those eight people might be here in this room, so I am very grateful to them for coming. So I was, you know, I was determined I will give them a good performance, and I was greeted by an elderly lady. Everybody there was elderly. I have nothing to say about that. I am elderly myself. These, however, were super elderly. And And the first lady came and she presented, she put something around my neck, which I took it to be some sort of laurel or something, a welcome from San Francisco, like a lei, like a Hawaiian lei or something, around my neck. And then another one came and did the same. And then a third lady came and did the same. I thought, well, at least I'm welcomed here. And then I looked down and I couldn't work out what they were. And they said, well, these are cables that will plug directly into our hearing aid. And if it's necessary for me to do the same tonight, I will do this. So here is a difference that it's made. But can I just tell you one thing, since something tells me I'm with family in a sense, and I actually do have members of my family.
It's called mishpocha.
Mishpocha, yes, I feel. just to tell you a little thing about my mother's response to the week before I won the prize, she rang me up. She was very excited, of course. And she rang me up to say, look, I want you to know you're not going to win this prize. the book's too Jewish. But even if it were not too Jewish, you're not going to win this prize. This was not a mother trying to bring down a son. She cares for me, and I know that all my life she's tried to stop me hoping for too much because she wishes to spare me disappointment. When I was 17 years old or 18 years old, a telegram arrived from Cambridge University to say I had won a place. And my mother brought me the envelope and stood by and waited, and I opened the telegraph and I said, yes, I am in. And she went very quiet and she said, maybe we should check the address just to be certain it's for you. So on the morning of the prize, she rings again and says, I'm just checking to make sure that you're not hoping to win tonight. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm absolutely not. And I wasn't. She did such a good job on me. She's done such a good job on me all my life that I expect to win nothing. It's one of the reasons I am a novelist, is that I expect nothing from life. And so I write novels about worlds in which at least I can make something happen in which, you know, if I lose, and I always write about losers, at least I'm in charge of the losing. So I go to the dinner. It's a grand dinner at the Guildhall in London, and the TV cameras are there. And my mother had said, by the way, it's on the news tonight, but I won't be watching. I said, that's good, because there's no point. She said, precisely, there's no point. Anyway, I go to the dinner, absolutely convinced I won't win, happy, eating well, drinking well. Everybody else is nervous because everybody thinks that they or their writer will win. I don't think I will win. And then I win. I have to tell you just one thing, though, that as Sir Andrew Motion, the chairman of the judges, announces the winner, he comes to it very, very slowly, saying, you know, the winner of this year's Man Booker Prize has these qualities. He talks about a sense. It's funny. I thought, well, that could be me, but it could also be Peter Carey and somebody else. And yet it's melancholy. I thought, that's me too. Then he used the word plangent, and I think, well, I am plangent. I'm very plangent. And as the words are coming together and I'm thinking it's sounding more and more like me, it could be me, it could be me. And he says, and the winner of this, of the 2010 Man Booker Prize, and then I hear the name Finkler. And I think, this Finkler, this Finkler has stolen
my
prize.
Took your prize.
My wife thinks the same and she's consoling me. But anyway, I win the prize, and then I'm whisked away and give press conferences around the world, and I think I must ring my mother. So I ring my mother, because, of course, she's been at home not following it. And I get through, and then I hear there's a party going on at home. So she has been... So I said, ah, so you watched the news? She said, yes, something made me watch the news after all. And I said, so everything's all right. She says, well, just one thing. You made a speech. I did. I made a speech. Although I knew I wasn't going to win, I had a little speech, just in case. I never go anywhere without a little speech, just in case. She said, you were making the speech, and just as I was seeing you on the news making the speech, they moved away. They said, there's some news from Chile. The Chilean miners have just come out, and the cameras were on the Chilean miners. She said, they'd been down there for 6 months. She said, would 10 more minutes have made any difference?
Your mother was the only person disappointed by the Chilean miners' release.
Well, we don't know that the families of the Chilean miners weren't watching me making my speech and thinking the same thing.
Well, speaking of plangency as well as comedy, I thought, for many of you may have already enjoyed the Finkler question. Some of you may not know it. And I thought it would be really nice to have you give us just a little taste of the book and your writing, which I think has, as Stephanie mentioned, a wonderful combination of delicate comedy, raucous comedy, as well as some very melancholy strain. So I think you've chosen a selection.
I've chosen a passage that might... Can I read it from
Please.
There?
Then I can feel... Orate away.
And I will orate. This is a small passage about... I'm not going to tell you the story of the novel now, but there are three main male characters in it. One of them, Libor, who was born in Czechoslovakia. He's 90 now. He was a show business journalist, the friend of Marilyn Monroe and Sophia Loren and people like that. And he's lost his wife recently. It was a woman he loved for 60 years, and he is heartbroken. And the novel is partly the story of him dealing with this heartbreak. But he's a very alive man, and his friends don't want to see him sinking in despair. Although he's 90, they don't want to feel that he's, you know, it's the end for him now. So they arrange for him to have an evening out with a younger woman. "What's your favourite colour?" she asks. "Oh, Mozart." "And your star sign?" My eyesight? No, your star sign. Your star. Oh, star, Jane Russell. So had begun Libor's first date of his widowhood. The girl, she must have been in her late 30s, but that still made her a girl to Libor, did not appear to know who Jane Russell was. Libor wondered where the problem lay, in the accent he had not quite lost or the hearing he had not quite kept. It was beyond his comprehension that Jane Russell could simply have been forgotten. "R-U-S-S-E-L-L," he spent out. "Jane, J-N-E, beautiful big." He did the thing men do, or used to do, weighing the fullness of a woman's breasts in front of him like a merchant dealing in sacks of flour. His date for the evening looked away. She had no chest to speak of herself, Libor realized, and must therefore have been affronted by his mercantile gesture. Though if she'd had a chest, she might have been more affronted still. The things you had to remember with a woman you hadn't been married to for half a century. The feelings you had to take into account. A great sadness overcame him. He wanted to be laughing with his wife Malky over it. "And then I..." "Libor, you didn't say that." I did. "Libor." He sighed, wanting it to be over, and showed the girl his hands. The flesh, disfigured with liver spots, was loose enough for her to slide her fingers under. It would peel clean away like the skin on a lightly roasted chicken. His knuckles were swollen, his fingernails dull and yellow and bent over at the ends. Then he ran his hands over his baldness and inclined his head. He had always been a balding man. Balding had suited him, but he was plucked clean by time now. The patina of extreme old age was on him. He wanted the girl to see her own reflection in his head, measure all the time she had left in the dull mirror of his antiquity. He could tell she couldn't figure out what he was showing her. When he used to present his bald head to Malky, she would polish it with her sleeve. It used to excite her, not just the head, but the act of polishing it, as though he were her furniture. It amused him, too, to be her furniture. "You can open my drawers whenever you like," he would say, and she would laugh and cuff him with her sleeve. At the end, when she was dying in front of his eyes, they had talked dirty to each other. It was their defense against pathos. She wanted him to laugh because they had laughed so often together. Laughter had been his most precious gift to her, and now, at the last, she wanted laughter to be her final gift to him. "I'm sorry," he told the girl, calling for the bill. "This isn't fair to you." She was as relieved as he was when they parted. Thank you.
Well, Libor is one of three driving forces, three main characters in the novel. And because of the title, when I came to read it, I presumed that Finkler was in a way the protagonist. He's really not.
He's not. No.
Nor is Libor.
No.
It's Julian Treslev. So first I want to ask you, Finkler comes to stand in, the name, the word Finkler comes to stand in among your for your protagonist, Julian Treslev. It's sort of what he calls Jews.
Yes.
So that struck me as something dangerous for you to propose a kind of euphemism for a Jew and then put it in your title. Because if you translate your title, the Finkler question, it becomes the Jewish question.
Yeah.
Judenfrage, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell a little bit about how you came to this.
Well, the Jewish question, of course, is one of the most poisonous titles of anything. There were several books in the 19th century called The Jewish Question, and Marx himself wrote a book often translated as The Jewish Question. And the Jewish question really meant, what are we going to do about the Jews? How are we going to even get rid of the Jews? I mean, to the Jewish question, there has to be a solution. And when any Jew hears that phrase, the Jewish question, they also hear the final solution, though that wasn't everybody's solution to the Jewish question. So it's a poisonous title. I like the idea of Julian Treslev, who isn't Jewish, but who is naively and innocently in love with Jews, really, or in love with some idea of Jews, stumbling into this area, calling Jews Finklers without hearing everything that we hear in that word. Though I think in America you hear something even uglier than we do. I don't think a Fink quite carries in England what it carries here. But you hear lots of unpleasant things. And for him, it's just he thinks Finkler is his friend at school. Sam Finkler is his school friend, and it's his first Jew he's ever met. And there are many English people who don't meet or know many Jews. I still occasionally do readings in places, and I am well aware that I am the first Jew that any English person has met. And their curiosity about what being a Jew is not horrible, it's quite innocent. One said to me the other day at a reading, I was reading in Wells, the cathedral town, Trollope country, where not many Jews live. And one heard me talk and she came afterwards to me, a very nice looking woman, who was obviously married to somebody in the church whose name I wouldn't know, an arch something or another, presbyter or something, some of these. And she said, do you mind if I tell you that you have a rather wonderful face? I said, no, I don't. And I gave her... not at all. She said, we have an old Jew in our village who looks just like you. It wasn't anti-Semitic. Truly, it wasn't. It was naive. They, forgive them, Lord, they know not what they say. So I wanted Treslev to be one of those, yeah, really, who, blundering into all sorts of ideas about what Jews are, accurate and inaccurate, it struck me as a very funny way to go back into the Jewish question, which seems to be a question I can't stop asking myself for some reason.
And you have. A lot of your work really does focus, or you're willing to be very out in that way, very open and public about questioning, debating publicly the role of Jews, the visibility of Jews, this question of assimilation versus visibility. And maybe for an American audience, you can try to discern a little bit for us the distinction between what it means, at least for you, to be out and public as a public Jewish intellectual in the UK versus what you know about the US.
It's very different. Let me preface it by saying that I do not walk the streets of London in danger. Having said that, no doubt I will be attacked the minute I get there. But that's not what it's like. I know sometimes I'm asked in what's it like? Do the Muslims attack you? Are there anti-Semites on every corner? No. Occasionally, if I write an article in one of the papers I write for, I do a column for The Independent newspaper, which is not a newspaper famous for its fondness of Israel, but I am one of those that redress the balance somewhat. If I write an obviously pro-Zionist article, I will get a little bit of hate mail, but I won't fear for my life. I've had no hate mail in relation to this novel, none, which is interesting. But all that being said, it is different being a Jew in England than it is here. There are only 300,000 Jews in the whole of England. Most of them are in London. Then there's Manchester and Birmingham. That's that. We do not figure in the culture in the way that Jews in America figure in the culture.
You're listening to novelist Howard Jacobson in conversation with Peter Stein on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
If I was to say, for example, you know, to anybody in England, name me an American novelist that you like reading, 75% of the names that they'd come up with would be Jewish. Sometimes one thinks, American literature, Jewish literature, what's the difference? Part of the vitality of American cultural life, not just novels but films and television, is Jewish vitality. The great thing about America is you feel these. America has always been able to make space for people that we would call in England people on the margins. The vitality of Italian culture here, the vitality of, you know, it just doesn't matter which.
Right.
Here you don't have, in a sense, what it means is you don't have margins. All the people that we would think of in England as marginal make up your culture. English culture is sort of sealed. You knock on the door, they might open the door a little, they might let you in, but at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know you have to leave. It's never quite yours. That doesn't mean I'm given a hard time, but they don't always get it, and sometimes one feels one's swimming against the current of the culture. You have to remember that England was the first, that was the first pogrom. The first European pogrom was not Spain or Portugal or Germany, it was England. We were kicked out. And there were no Jews in England except Jews who'd gone into hiding and forgotten about being Jewish for 400 years until Cromwell lets us in, mainly it's an economic reason, and there's also some cultural reason because they're Puritans and the Jews are going to bring in a new puritanical millennium. But they're not really in for being Jews. And Jews have stayed quiet in England ever since in the last few hundred years. We stay quiet because if we stay quiet, the English might not know we're here, there. And if they don't know we're there, they can't kick us out again, can they? I was brought up like that. All my generation were brought up like that. Shh, about being Jewish, stay stumm. When I first started writing about Jews, the response of many Jewish people, illiterate Jewish people in England, was, do you have to do that? Leave it. They sometimes say you're washing your dirty linen in public, even though you're not doing that at all. The general feeling, many, many Jews do well, are famous writers, are famous in the media, but very, very few of them are famous for what they do Jewishly.
Right.
They happen to be Jewish, but Jewishness is not at the center of what they make their films about or write their books about. I am one of the few.
So I think American Jewish culture had some of that experience post-war, late 40s and 50s. But you've created a character in Sam Finkler as someone who's taken that kind of social, I don't know if it's shyness or shame, and you've created a character who, as much as Julian Treslov is the kind of wannabe Jew, the person who naively lionizes or celebrates the Jews around him, even though he's not Jewish. One of your primary Jewish characters is carrying around a tremendous amount of shame. And I'm wondering, have you encountered or do you encounter the Sam Finklers of the world on a regular basis?
Yes, on a regular basis. And that's and one of the impulses for writing this novel was to take on what seems to me an old problem in a new shape. Jews who don't want to be Jewish, who want to jump the ship of Jewishness, or who don't want to be known as Jews, there's nothing uncommon about that. That's familiar. In England, they change their names. They go horse riding. you only have to see them on a horse to know, but... They become, you know, they were called, you know, Samuel Ezra Finkler, and they now become Christian Sunjan Shagert, and nobody will then know who. And that's kind of familiar and kind of sad, but okay, if that's what they want to do. You don't know. And certainly I wouldn't argue that you must go around proclaiming that you're Jewish all the time. I mean, there are many, many ways of being Jewish. You can be quite quiet about it. But this noisy not being Jewish is one of the features of being English in England, and it's a good subject for comedy, I think. But what's happened with the Middle East is that Israel has given a new impetus to this and a new reason for some Jews to be ashamed, so that now they're not ashamed of being Jews. They love being Jewish. In fact, they rediscover their Jewishness. They go on to a famous program, Finkler does, but that's simply... Finkler goes on to a program called Desert Island Discs, which is a well-known radio program in England, well-known, much-beloved radio program in England, in which you imagine you're a stowaway and you talk about your life and you're interviewed and you choose 8 records, favourite records, and then that's that. And Finkler goes on and does what I'd heard a well-known Jewish person doing a couple of years ago, to say, you know, my Jewishness is very important to me. Finkler's lying, his Jewishness was... This particular person I heard talking about their Jewishness, I didn't believe that either. I knew a little bit about it, but it didn't quite strike me as real. They refine their Jewishness in order to abandon it again. And they say, but I'm deeply, deeply ashamed of Israel. I'm deeply ashamed as a Jew of Israel. Who's asking? This is Desert Island Discs. It's a light radio program. Nobody is asking. There is, and this phenomenon of Jews, not just kind of Jews who've been talking about their Jewishness forever, suddenly worrying about Israel. And it's fair enough to have a political worry about what you like. But it's Jews who are rediscovering their Jewishness in order to get rid of it. There's another phenomenon too. You probably have these programs on American TV where personalities discover who they are, and they're taken around, and they discover who their ancestors were. Their program's called, you know, Who Do You Think You Are, or something like that. And and towards the end of the program, they suddenly discover that they're Jewish, and they suddenly discover that they've got a grandfather or an uncle who was killed in Auschwitz. So they're filmed outside Auschwitz, crying. This is an obligatory thing now for a personality who's refound their Jewishness. You schlep him to Auschwitz, they stand outside, and they cry outside out, and they say how wonderful it is to be Jewish. That's Monday night. Monday night. By the middle of the week, they've done an interview for The Times or The Guardian saying how it's wonderful. And they've always thought there was something not quite right. No, it felt. And that there was a kind of melancholy in them that couldn't be explained, a plangency that couldn't be explained. But also a cleverness, a sharpness of wit, which they... And whenever they meet Jews, they feel this affinity, you know, this warm affinity. And now they know they're Jewish, and it's wonderful. And that's Wednesday. Saturday, they're in Trafalgar Square carrying a banner saying, we are all Hezbollah. This is not an invention of mine. This is a discernible phenomenon.
You save your most wicked satire for what you see as the hypocrisy of the intellectual Jewish left. And I'm wondering if you have felt called upon some of your characters are duking it out, signing petitions, signing counter-petitions. Have you, as you say now, one of the rare publicly identified Jewish writers, do you yourself find that you need to be public about your political beliefs, whether with regard to Israel or anywhere else?
Well, you see, I wouldn't even call them political beliefs. I've now become associated with the non-intellectual left for obvious reasons, because I don't sign their letters to The Guardian saying this must happen, and I don't carry a poster saying we are all Hezbollah. So I am now associated with, you know, if people want to be rude about me, they call me, you know, a Zionist. I revel in the death of Palestinian babies. You know, I am now one of those. I try very hard. I'm a novelist. I also do a column, but even when I do my column, I try to do it as a novelist might do a column. I actually have no politics. People say this is disingenuous, but I don't have any politics. I don't understand politics, and I feel it's my job as a novelist not to. So when I'm invited to join counter-movements or to go to dinner at Anglo-Israeli events or something or other, I, on principle, hate missing out on any dinner. So it's not, it kills me to say, no, I can't do it. But I don't do it. So my hands are, you know, my hands are clean. I do not belong to any group. I am a novelist. I'll make fun of them all. You know, I'll make fun of the people for whom Israel can do no wrong, in the same way as I'll make fun of those for whom Israel can do nothing but wrong. Mm. Not quite true, because I think the people who think Israel can do nothing but wrong are more pernicious than the other one. But each, you know, each is responsible for the other. So I have to stay in the middle. I have to be free of all that. And I have to say that in this novel, I feel I'm not talking about Israel at all, though my characters talk about Israel. I mean, one of the jokes is that when Libor and Finkler meet, and Libor is an old Jewish Czech, and so, you know, has heard it all before, and feels that Israel is a very good idea because we never know when you might need to flee to it, but hasn't himself gone there. And when he talks about Israel, he makes it sound like the word of God. He calls it Israel. He puts that Israel, that noise in it. Whereas Finkler won't even say Israel. Finkler calls it Palestine, or when he's really angry, he calls it Canaan. So Israel becomes this...
And he puts an extra Y.
And then, yes. So it becomes... So Israel is just this thing that people talk about. It's a figment.
Right.
I think not only in my novel is Israel the figment. I actually think in the lives of many people who write about Israel on all sides, certainly in England this is true, it is no longer a real place. People are not actually describing a place where you live. I mean, I've made several documentaries in recent years that have involved my going to Israel, and you go to Israel and you meet every single kind of person. You know, your cameraman is a wild lefty who says more horrible things about the country he lives in, even than they say in The Guardian or in my paper, The Independent. And then you discover that he's working with the fixer who thinks something else. And you realize it's a country, like anywhere, it's a country. It's a place in which people are trying to live their lives, and they're at war, and they're frightened, and some of them are arrogant, and sometimes... And it bears no relation to this other place, which is becoming more and more and more of an exaggeration for people. And that's what I wanted to get, actually, how Israel is just—it's a burning figment in the minds of people.
Right. It's also an extremely powerful way to project one's own anxieties or concerns or fears. You do it
and self-righteousness and self-conceit. Mm. Yes.
What's amazing to me about the book is that you say you haven't received. Critique. Maybe it's because you've presented so many different points of views. You've got a kind of triangle of points of views, a fierce defender, a fierce doubter, a prophet type, a guardian type, guardian, small g, not your newspaper. And at the same time, there is, as Stephanie mentioned in her introduction, there is a pervasive kind of thrumming of anti-Semitic incidents that occur throughout to pretty much all of your characters. And I'm wondering about that sense of danger or violence just waiting on the outskirts of people's lives, specifically anti-Semitic violence. What's the background to bringing that into this novel?
Yes. Well, the novel begins with an attack. Treslov, the non-Jew, is attacked by some... Turns out to be a woman, but that's neither here nor there for this conversation. And he is mugged, and he has his phone taken and his wallet taken. But also, as he... The woman says something to him. His name's Julian and his nickname is Jules. And he thinks that she says, "You." Only afterwards, when the attack's over and he's calmed down, he thinks she said something. She said, "You Jules." What did she say? "You Jules?" Why would she have said that? Maybe she'd said, "Give me your Jules." Well, he's a man, he doesn't have Jules, except that Jules is also a kind of slang term for, you know, for a man's sexual equipment. Is it a sexual attack? Or did she, he suddenly thinks, say, "You Jew?" Did she call him a Jew? He's very excited by this because this might prove that he loves Jews, but he might be Jewish. And the novel is partly the story of his wanting to be Jewish. And Libor and Finkler said, "There's no evidence that you're Jewish." He says, "Precisely." And they say, "You're called Julian Treslov. That's not Jewish." "Precisely," he says. And they say, "Did your parents ever say anything to you about..." "No, they were keeping it secret. They never said a word." But this was this. So in his interest in becoming Jewish, he then and this idea that Jews, and suddenly now he's a Jew and he's been attacked. No sooner has he been a Jew than he's been attacked for being a Jew. So he just looks up in the newspapers, you know, what other attacks, and he discovers that there are lots of anti-Semitic most of them low level, but nonetheless, you know, swastikas being written on shul, places like this requiring security and so on, little old Jewish men being attacked on the way home and abused, children attacked at school and things. And he discovers that these things are happening. To what degree? He rings up Finkler and says, what do you think about this? And Finkler says, it's not exactly Kristallnacht, is it? He said, ring me back when you hear of a Jew being stabbed for being a Jew in broad daylight in Oxford Street, and then I will worry about it. That's a very important debate that's being had at the moment. The question of, is all the anti-Zionist discourse, and there's mountains of it, it is the default position. People don't even think about the subject, think they know that, you know, Israel is this hellhole capable of nothing else. Is this default anti-Zionist position leading to, whether it means to or not, anti-Semitism? That is something that Jews are asking all the time.
Everywhere.
And when I was writing this novel, which was at when Operation Kasled was happening and Israel had, you know, was bombing Gaza and people were marching through the streets saying terrible things. And every time Israel attacked, I mean, Israel never attacks anybody, it's a massacre. Everything is always a massacre and it's always slaughter. So the language is very inflated. And there is evidence to show that it did lead to small-scale anti-Semitic attacks. But could it lead to even greater anti-Semitic attacks? Or what if you don't even need to have anti-Semitic attacks? What if it makes your life uncomfortable and painful to hear Israel, which is, after all, a Jewish project, it's unmistakably a Jewish project, just reviled all the time, day and night, reviled, reviled, reviled. That starts to make Jews uncomfortable. Even some of the people who become ashamed Jews that I know, the real-life ashamed Jews I know, do sometimes say, it is worrying how this thing seems to shade off into something else. So you don't have to be punched in the face to feel that you are under attack. Just the noise coming from the media, the noise from television and from the newspapers can make one feel frightened and uncomfortable and distressed.
Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the trajectory of your character, Sam Finkler, who at the beginning is kind of carrying the standard for
yes.
the ashamed Jews
yes.
and attacking Israel
yes.
pretty much at every turn. And gradually, as he looks at the world around him, he begins to think this maybe he's not as comfortable with the attacks against Israel as he might be. And I'm wondering, have you seen a shift or a modulation of any kind? You talk about the British press and the sort of vitriol that comes out against Israel in the British press, and there's a lot of it in the States as well. Have you seen any of that modulate at all? Do you find that there's any nuance to be had about it?
Just the tiniest bit. Just the tiniest bit of late, I've heard people who would normally say, anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism, which of course you have to say, you have to believe it isn't. And then I always say, it isn't, but that doesn't mean it might not be. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it can't not be. You know, the syllogism is false. I am an anti-Zionist, I am not anti-Semitic, therefore no anti-Zionism can ever be anti-Semitic. That's a nonsense. And the other one is, I am anti-Zionist and I am a Jew, so I can't be anti-Semitic. And we all know that the biggest anti-Semites we ever meet will turn out to be Jews, or some of them. Jews can do anti-Semitism like nobody else. I think there is... We invented it. We invented Christianity. We invented a religion that would be, you know, that would give us more trouble than any. We invented Christianity. We can't be... We have to have this... We can only understand ourselves adversarially. And I'm just starting to notice that one or two of the people who would, you know, absolutely not go with me an inch on this are just starting to say it is worrying, it is beginning to be worrying now, the degree to which it is assumed always that Israel is vilely in the wrong, and the way in which, well, only a few weeks ago we had stories coming from here. We heard Charlie Sheen's kind of routine anti-Semitic. We had the Galliano story, which he would have got. We had a week in which there were about five different incidents. Julian Assange mm-hmm. talking about Jewish conspiracies. Well, we had one week, and every single Jewish writer in England was writing about this strange week in which wherever we looked, in America, in England, in France, wherever we looked, it seemed that there was the old anti-Semitic discourse was coming back. And everyone had to ask this question, has it been enabled by anti-Zionism? In fact, has it been made possible to talk about Jews in the old medieval way, as people, for example, there was a famous play on in London called Seven Jewish Children, a piece of just nonsense, five-minute propaganda nonsense, in which the Jews appear on the stage at the end, almost with blood coming out of their mouths, saying how they rejoice in the death of Palestinian babies. And I and others thought that they detected in this echoes, unwitting echoes, of the old blood libel. You know, this was Jews love spilling the blood of Gentile babies. It's such, you know, you want to kill because you want to kill them. A, because it's such a wicked thing to say, but B, because it's such ludicrous nonsense. Jews don't spill anybody's blood lightly. We're very particular about blood. If I cut my finger, I disinfect the house.
It's not a very imaginative libel either. It's kind of old and tired and done.
Cheers.
And done.
Cheers.
With.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features novelist Howard Jacobson in conversation with Peter Stein. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Your characters, speaking now of blood and body parts, there is a particular fixation that Julian Treslov, your kind of wannabe, almost maybe Jewish character,
yes,
has with his, well, now I have to be delicate because we're on the radio, with his member and the fact that he himself is still uncircumcised.
Yes.
And long sections of the novel.
I think they're not that short sections of them.
Short sections. Do treat this question of circumcision as a signifier of Jewish identity. Actually, they were fascinating and quite kind of obsessive. At least Julian is, and I'm wondering what your own fascination.
I think it's
Let
time
me
for
finish.
Questions.
Do you find that you are yourself fascinated by the physical distinction between Jews and Gentiles? I should have just left it at that question, right?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I began an earlier novel with called Kaluki Nights, with a scene in which the hero of Kaluki Nights is a cartoonist, and he for a while he describes how he works as an illustrator of pirated gay cartoons, and in fact the particular, I don't know whether you know, there's a particular character called Tom of Finland, who I actually only ever discovered when I was in San Francisco the last time, and I was wandering around Castro and looking in the bookshops and discovered that there was this character called Tom of Finland who wears a Nazi hat and gambles with other men. They're all bulging muscles and things, and stretched trousers and all that. And it's part of it's cult gay porno. And my Jewish hero describes how he had to work doing Tom of Finland copies, but could do it all very well, but couldn't do the strain in the leather trousers. Couldn't do it. And he sees this as because that's not how Jewish men dress. They don't wear tight leather. Jewish men wear, you know, pleated, loose trousers under a cardigan. And this leads to him then thinking about the whole business of, you know, of this subject. But in the Not in Finkler, we could talk for a long time about that. I've got theories about that. But in Finkler, when Julian Treslov falls in love with a Jewish woman called Hepzibah Weizenbaum, just so that we all know that she's definitely a Jewish woman. He says, I want to be Jewish for you. I want to be a good Jewish husband. I'll be circumcised. She says, just don't worry about it. Don't bother. But he becomes fascinated by it. And it gave me a chance to show off some of my scholarship, which is that there are people out there who, as part of their not wanting to be Jewish anymore, are reversing circumcision. You can do it. Now, we could decide whether you want me to tell you how to do it or not. The process is called, in Greek, epispasis, And you can't actually reverse the thing, but what you can do is that you can disguise whatever, or what you've already got by use of heavy weights and pulleys and many hours of exercise. You can disguise what you've got so that you don't look as though you're circumcised. And there are some people who talk, you can find this on the web, there are some people who will describe to you how you do it. And they want to do it because they see circumcision as a Jewish plot. Some of the people who, as a Jewish plot to feminize men. What it is, they say, is this was something that the Jews came up with to take the potency away from men. It's a conspiracy.
Well,
if we reverse that, men will be men again, and yet another Jewish conspiracy can be thwarted. I can describe in great detail.
I was going to say, now that we've already been ghettoized to the 3 a.m. slot on at the very left side of the dial. On that note, I think it's quite appropriate to see if we have questions from our audience, and please line up along the side. So Stephanie and Sarah have mics, and we would love to hear your questions for Howard.
Finkler's question seems like such a Jewish novel. How did non-Jews react to some of the things that seem like within the family humor?
Well, it's a good question, and it's something that cropped up in all the events that I did immediately, certainly in the Jewish events that I did in England after the prize, and I don't only do Jewish events, but there was always a moment when someone would ask that question you've asked, and they'd say, well, you've won the prize with it, and that's terrific, and that means that the Jewish experience has now been validated in English culture, and we feel that we're now, how we live and how we think and express ourselves has become part of English culture at last. But do they really know what this book is? Do they really know what they've given the prize to? Well, I must assume that they do. I mean, they read every novel before it goes onto the long list. Then they read every long-listed novel again before it goes onto the short list. And then they read every novel again before they decide that I'm the one to give it to.
Sounds like a question from your mother, actually. Are you sure?
Well, everybody is my mother, really. This is the thing. Everybody is my mother or my father or my daughter or my son. There are no other relations. I must assume that they have. And I must assume that it means that not only Jews are growing a little wary of these old stereotypes, and that it's perfectly possible for there was a Jewish member of the judging panel, I have to say, but there's no reason to believe that she was a dominant voice. I have to assume that they sort of got it and took it. And the point that you made, which is that we hear all voices, so it doesn't feel a particularly politically Jewish novel, although there are definitely Jewish politics in it, made them feel that wasn't an issue for them. And that in the end, the writing won out over everything. And for me, that's the most important. I am a writer before I am an Englishman or a Jew. I am a writer. I have to say, yes, they knew what they gave the prize to. And it's too late if they didn't.
The most resonant line in your book, and plangent line in your book for me, was his statement, "Why do you exaggerate our presence so much?" And I can't remember whether it's Finkler or Libor says it to Julian. Why do you exaggerate our presence? And that has been, in the lives of many of certainly me and my friends, the question we ask ourselves endlessly. And some people say it's we, the Jews, who exaggerate our own presence, and others who say they exaggerate ours. And I wondered if you'd address that.
Yes, well, I know exactly what you mean, and I certainly am someone that exaggerates the whole business of being Jewish to myself and to my readers. But at the same time, I think it's possible to admit that and say that sometimes you feel that the Gentile world has Jews on the brain. I do feel that there are people out there who just have Jews on the brain. And I think Israel is just Israel often is an opportunity for non-Jews to express the Jewness on the brain from which they suffer. We could talk for hours about why why people have Jews on the brain. You could say that Jews have Jews on the brain and non-Jews have Jews on the brain and the whole world has got Jews on the brain. You could say that. Sometimes that, when I've got a book to sell, I think that's a rather a good thing, actually. But philosophically, why we've got Jews on the brain is really very interesting. Freud said something that I think could be the clue to it. Freud, looking at how anti-Semitism in the last century, in the middle of the last century, was at its most virulent in those countries where paganism had lingered longest. And he talked about the Baltic states, where my mother's family came from in Lithuania, and other places like that, where, you know, only 1,000 years ago they were worshipping trees. Christianity came along, and Freud argues this, that Christianity came along supplanted paganism, but the paganism of these countries lingered, and a resentment of Christianity lingered. And he said something which I think is quite fascinating, that the Jews are in fact blamed for Christianity. That it is understood, although, you know, we always have to say, now, can we remind you, please, that Jesus Christ was Jewish and that Christianity was actually, in its earliest version, was our idea, not your idea. Although we have to remind the non-Jewish world of that, somewhere or other, Freud seems to imply, they know it and they can't forgive us for it. So they can't forgive us for killing Jesus and they can't forgive us for coming up with Jesus. Which means, really, they just can't forgive us. And therefore, they have us on the brain. It is, I think, still an extraordinary idea, although it's now being rejected by atheists and so on, the idea, the monotheistic idea of one God, a God you can't see. And when you have an idea of a God you can't see, it's an act of intellection. It's not just spirituality, but intellectual. It's an idea. The Jewish God is an idea. The pagan God is this. That's a god. I worship the god of this table. I worship the god of this room. That god's no good. I'll worship another god. I worship the god of that microphone. The Jewish god is an idea you can't change. The only way you can change the Jewish god is to stop being Jewish, which is what lots of Jews do, which is why I think lots of Jews are always stopping being Jewish, because it's too difficult. The single Jewish god is too difficult. So I think somewhere or other, the world is at war with what the Jews have done to the body, to nature, to the intellect. It's hard for people. It's resented by people. And I think it's also resented by Jews. I sometimes feel it. I sometimes feel, why am I this thing? Why am I this neurasthenic thing of idea and not body? This could have been the opportunity to talk about my novel about table tennis. Which is also, I think, on sale down, which has also just come out over here, which is the story of a Jewish boy whose parents don't want him to do any sports because it's too dangerous, who discovers the game of table tennis, who shows his mother that the first world table tennis champion, who was called Jacoby, who won the world championships, I think, in 1925 or 1928, won it while wearing a cardigan. And he shows his mother the cardigan so his mother will know that if she lets him play this sport, he'll be warm all the time.
I've heard tell that this is your most autobiographical novel.
It's a highly autobiographical novel. Highly autobiographical.
It's called The Mighty Walzer, and in fact it is just published in paperback, or reissued in paperback in the States. And before we get to a question on this side, I just wanted to follow up on this distinctiveness, the sort of obsession of Jews and the rest of the world to think about Jewishness. And I'm wondering if you think it also has to do with this question of Jews taking it upon themselves, or many, as being chosen or selected or special, and the simultaneous rejection of that by many secular and cultural Jews saying, I don't want that pressure. I don't want that. I prize my cultural identity and the sort of social and tribal aspects of Jewish life, but I am not going to be called upon to bring a special consideration. Yes. And to set myself apart.
Yes. It's caused a lot of trouble, that idea of the chosen people. It's caused a hell of a lot of trouble. Moses Maimonides is wonderful about what it means. The trouble is, and he's right about what it means. He argues that what it means, it's not about our being better than anybody else or superior than anybody else. It's actually about a burden. This was a burden that the Jews understood God had laid upon them, which was to follow God, to pursue God, to think about God. In other words, to commit themselves to the intellectual life. But when you meet a rabid anti-Semite, I mean, I met a Holocaust denier in a garden party a couple of years ago. Just met one. There was a Holocaust denier then, who actually said, "Hello, I'm a Holocaust denier." And then stood there and I said, "Well, what does a Holocaust denier do at a garden party? Should I stand here and I deny the Holocaust?" So she denied the Holocaust and I proved the Holocaust, and we had that conversation. But and she brought up this, and you think you're special and all that. It's very, very hard at that point to kind of, because you're not carrying Moses Maimonides with you, which you should be, to actually say, well, what he said was, and it's very important, that this is not special in the sense of being set apart for favour. It's special in the sense of being set apart for labour, for
responsibility.
Work. But it's also a kind of abnegation. It's an abnegation of... But there's still a kind of, in the end, there is a kind of intellectual pride in it. It's an abnegation from the labours of the mere flesh. And I think and that is what, you know, whether Jews live a fleshly life or not, at the heart of the Jewish religion is this sense of abnegation. And I think that means we are at the root of an argument at the very heart of life. We are one side of an argument at the very heart of life. You know, all the great divisions, body, mind, spirit, intellect, you know, duty, self. And therefore, I think we will always be at the heart of the main argument that humanity has with itself.
Well, what is good is the vigor with which you approach the complexity of Jewish identity and the joy that you bring to us as readers, even with that hint, and sometimes more than a hint, of plangency and sadness. So, Howard Jacobson, thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you, Peter. That was so nice. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was novelist Howard Jacobson, who is joined in conversation by Peter Stein, executive director of the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Michael Geese Graphics, Brandon Battaglia, Devin Cruikshank, and David Kwan. David Kwan also edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature journalist Christopher McDougall. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening. Thank you.